the program commences another day, and it's a Friday, so therefore the program will shut down for the weekend.
What? I thought we worked every day.
You can work every day.
Yeah, well.
McCowan and Shannon with you. Jason Stark is going to join us from The Athletic. We're going to talk baseball. And specifically about an article that he wrote recently for The Athletic about the Toronto Blue Jays, their future, the way the team organization has been built, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, as typical of us Canadians, they write nice things. We have to talk to them. You know, that's what we have to do. We want to be loved by Americans.
Well, yeah, we do have that insecurity thing.
Oh, don't we?
Just a touch.
Don't we?
Not so many days ago, we had Nick Foligno on while he was isolating up in Sudbury. He played his first hockey game last night for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Mm-hmm. Played on the number one line.
Only because Hyman was hurt, right?
I'll give you that. But nonetheless, he hardly looked out of place and was a significant contributor to the end of a five-game winless streak for the Toronto.
Yeah, he was good. The game, I it's funny. After the first two shots went in, I thought the game was rather sloppy on both sides. But there is something right now. It's funny. Winnipeg can't beat Edmonton, and Winnipeg can't beat Toronto. And yet, I would tell you that Winnipeg's the best team in the North. But you know, they got, you know, Jack Campbell beat Connor Hellebuck last night. Connor Hellebuck got chased out of the game.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be one of the best goalies in hockey. It's the North Division and how they get to the playoffs. It's going to be fascinating what happens between, particularly with Edmonton, Winnipeg, Toronto, and don't forget Montreal has Edmonton's number almost every time as well. So the playoffs are going to be just great.
Well, I'll let Foligno know of the that you've discounted the significance of his appearance.
Yes. Well, don't worry. I know he's an avid listener. He's a subscriber.
Okay. Well, if he's not aware, I'll pass it along to him.
Because you guys are such good friends.
Well, you can deal with him. It has nothing to do with friendship. So I don't want to go into a corner with him.
I mean, the fact now you're talking to athletes, you know, is just another story for another day. So,
well, bring that up when we have time. Jason Stark of The Athletic is standing by. We'll chat with him baseball when we come back after these messages. I think it is fair to say that the Toronto Blue Jays' start to this season has been uneven. Injuries have been a factor, but they're a factor for every team all the time.
Mm.
And they're going to get some guys back. Hernandez is going to be back in not too long. And Springer, we expect to see maybe this weekend, but almost certainly, unless there's a recurrence, next week.
Well, when was the last time you had a torn oblique or a strained oblique?
John, I can't recall ever having one of those. I try not to move too quickly on the couch.
You can't even spell oblique.
That injury. Jason Stark of The Athletic joins us, and thanks a lot for your time today. You spent some time exploring this Blue Jay roster from within and without and trying to make some kind of evaluation of where they're going. Just on a personal level, are they doing all the right things? Are they going in the right direction?
You know, Bob, they are really building something that has a chance to be unique and powerful. And that's why when Mark Shapiro over the winter at the George Springer press conference used the word behemoth to describe what he thought they could be. Like, that's not a word you hear every day.
No.
It got my attention. So I decided I would start asking people, could this franchise be a behemoth? And regardless of what is going on in April in Dunedin, if you really take a step back and look at the long-term potential, there is upside here that you don't see literally in any other franchise in the game.
There's no question that they have talent among their young players. And this organization has done a good job in putting together that group. But they are not without flaws. And most of them are defensive. Some of them are under production offensively at this stage. But I think we've all been around baseball long enough to understand that 22, 23, 24-year-old guys, there's still a future there. The dilemma that the Toronto Blue Jays have had is not about signing free agents as much as it's about keeping free agents together? What makes you think that this organization, or maybe I should ask, why does Shapiro feel he can keep this nucleus together if they are as good as they appear to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one I asked. It's one people asked me. I asked it to Pat Gillick, for example. You know, Pat Gillick's the only man ever to build a World Series champion in Toronto, in Canada. And he had a really interesting perspective on it. Obviously, money is a huge factor. And it means Rogers is going to have to commit to spend that money, to spend what it takes to sign players and keep players. But what Pat said, what George Springer's agent Casey Close said, was basically the same thing. Players want to win, you know? And if this has the making of a franchise that looks like it's going to win in the short term and win in the long term in a great city, in a great market with great fans who they will play in front of someday, I'm sure, like, that's enough as long as you're willing to spend fair, competitive money. But it ain't going to happen without that.
You know, one of the things, Jason, that when you look at it, when does Behemoth become a measurable? When do you look at it and say, okay, they've got all the pieces. They don't have all the pieces yet, because I think that people would look at their bullpen and maybe even their starters and say, hey, there's a problem. But when do they think the Behemoth will start to rise out of the ground, maybe?
Yeah, this has been probably the biggest source of debate since I wrote this thing. And even while I was working on it, J.P. Ricciardi said to me, you know, when I think of a Behemoth, I think of the Yankees. I think of the Dodgers. I think of Alabama football. I think these are teams that don't go away. You can't just do this for 1 year or a few years. You got to do it for 20 years. So maybe you should have me back on in 2041 and we'll see if that's what they created. But like, Behemoth is a complicated word. Heard from a lot of Rays fans on Twitter, for example, saying, hey, we're the Behemoth. They're not. You know, you can't have the lowest payroll in baseball or next to lowest or whatever and be last in attendance and think you're a Behemoth. It's not just about the wins and the losses. You got to look at the big picture and what the franchise is capable of. And so that means continuing to build off of this group, off of this foundation, on and off the field, and then keep doing it.
Actually, you know, you in the call, in the article, which in itself is a Behemoth.
Because I'll take that as a compliment.
Well, no, that's the magic of The Athletic, right? You don't have, there's no editor saying, okay, we got to take six paragraphs out. You're one of the few people that actually acknowledge that this is perhaps the largest local market in baseball. When you think of 35 million Canadians, 7 or 8 million television cable households, this is bigger than what the Yankees market is. This is bigger than the Dodgers market too. And people in America don't necessarily understand that very often.
Yeah, that's exactly right. 7 million people aren't watching Yankee games. I don't care. You know, it could be the game 5 of the ALDS, man. 7 million New Yorkers are not watching the Yankees. People in LA couldn't even watch the Dodgers for a long time. The power of all those eyeballs and all those fans is unique in North American sports. Now, I don't know what happens if Montreal winds up getting a team. I can't tell you where the Canadian and U.S. economies are going or what the exchange rate's going to be. I don't know those things. But there's no team in North American professional sports that has the power to engage as many people as the Toronto Blue Jays do. And that is a powerful thing to say.
You alluded earlier to the lure of coming to Canada, being about, at least in part, the notion of winning, because all players want to win. The question becomes, how many guys want to win more than they want to get paid? And with an 80-cent dollar, it is difficult for a Canadian sports franchise in the NBA, even in the NHL, to compete with American dollars. And then you add in this intangible of having to cross the border 40 or 50 times a year, which we've all done. And once in a while, it's not a big deal, but to do it once or twice a week becomes a challenge. And what I think John and I have seen being here in Southern Ontario over the history of the Toronto Blue Jays is players will come, but ultimately they will be lured away. You can sign the free agent.
Or be discouraged because it's laborious at times to go through customs every day.
Well, these are all factors, and I'm not sure that we can dismiss them as mitigating factors in the future of the franchise. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is a big challenge, Bob. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, I talked to people other than the people quoted in this story who expressed these thoughts, you know, and I, like, if I wanted to write 10,000 words, I could have gotten into all of this, but
sure.
I did have an agent, a prominent agent, say to me, here's when you know you're a behemoth. When a player has a choice between the Dodgers and the Blue Jays and says, I want to go to Toronto. You know, you're going to have to really build something special to make that happen. And you're going to have to pay what it takes to make that happen. Because there are certain challenges that go with playing in Canada that you don't have anywhere else, that you're going to have to probably overpay a little bit for. It's just a reality of the situation. The question is, do you always have to overpay in dollars? Maybe you don't.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're all right, Toronto is a great city. It offers opportunities that maybe you don't have everywhere else. You can certainly offer those. The livability, the convenience, the power, the diversity of the city, those are all selling points that I think Toronto can use to its advantage. And then if you build the right culture, if you build a team that contends perennially, it's amazing what players will forget about, you know, that they won't get obsessed about when it comes time to deciding, where do I want to play? You know, Buck Martinez was a guy I talked to at length. I didn't quote Buck a lot on this, but he used the example of Mark Burley. Remember Mark Burley when he signed with the Marlins, got traded to the Blue Jays, didn't want to be there. He was complaining about his dog and all those issues. A month into it, he was trying to recruit other players to play in Toronto. There are examples of that because it's such an amazing city.
Beeston and Gillick in the early 1990s were a tag team, I think you're aware, in trying to lure free agents specifically to come to Toronto. But it happened at a time when the Blue Jays were a solid organization, had been knocking on the door, had had several playoff years, and they just needed to get over the hump. Those two guys were able to sell a significant number of players, many of them at the end of their careers, but nonetheless, to come and push the Blue Jays over the hump, and they wind up winning back-to-back World Series. How different is it now in what Shapiro and Atkins are doing, given that the Toronto Blue Jays, I mean, with the exception of last year and that asterisk of the goofy playoffs thing, haven't been anywhere. They got good young players, but they haven't proven anything. What's the difference here?
Well, you just said it. Track record matters, and they're not at the stage that those teams were at. I don't think there's any doubt about it. Pat Gillick acknowledged that. But in terms of talent already on the team and what it could be, talent in the system, talent that's coming, you know, the Athletic, Keith Law, we rank all the farm systems, and the Blue Jays are ranked number three in the sport. And if you watch some of their young arms this year in spring training, you can see, like, you could have a staff full of 3-4 potential number one starters if they all stay healthy. You know, the makings are there for what Pat Gillick and Paul Beeston built. They're not there yet, but that's part of the process. And that's why I think, and I made this point in the story, George Springer, that signing, that addition was really important because that's a signal to other players, to other teams, to other agents of this is a really respected, big time winning player who has played on World Series winners, who wanted to play in Toronto. Could have gone to New York. There's a lot of talk about him going to the Mets, right? He wound up going to the Blue Jays. Mm-hmm. And it takes signings like that to make a statement to other players that this is a place to be.
I don't argue the significance of the Springer sign, even though we haven't seen him in a regular season games right yet. Nonetheless, didn't it really start with Ryu's signing? I mean, he's not the same kind of guy, but this is a guy who left the Dodgers, a perennially great team, to come north of the 49th parallel to join a ball club that had a bunch of babies, a bunch of 20, 21-year-olds that may or may not mature into significant ball players. I mean, and this is a frontline major league pitcher. I thought that was almost more significant. Your thoughts on that?
You know, I think maybe from a baseball standpoint, you could make that case that it was more significant because he filled a really important need, and you've seen how good he can be. He hadn't stayed healthy over the life of the contract. That's been an issue for him, but I think
so far so good.
Yeah, he's tremendous. When he gets to the mound, he's as good as anybody. But I think the sense in the sport was nobody else was willing to pay him what the Blue Jays were willing to pay him. That's why he went to Toronto. And, you know, that sends a certain message too. But I don't think it sends the same message as George Springer, who you could argue was the signature position player free agent this winter. And he wound up going to the Toronto Blue Jays. Mm. You know, I just think that reverberates with players in a different way than Ryu did.
You know, the other thing is, and you kind of alluded to it, that, you know, there are eyeballs on signings, but, you know, other players, agents looking at it. I wonder what kind of effect having name recognition, not necessarily the right players, but name recognition of former baseball players' kids playing here. Everybody knows who Vladdy Guerrero is. Well, his son's here. There's a Bichette here. There's a Biggio here. So does name recognition help?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. But, you know, what also helps is all of them can really play.
Yeah.
You know, I know Cavan's off to a slow start this year, but Bo Bichette is a superstar. Vladdy is electrifying. You know, I like when Kevin Biggio gets it going, how much fun is that guy to watch? And, you know, so obviously you're familiar with the names, but if you watch them play, this is one of the most fun lineups in the game. I know they haven't hit like it so far, but once they settle in, I've told a lot of people this. If you're going to ask me, all right, pick five teams you would love to watch every single night, the Blue Jays are on the list, not just because of the name recognition, just but because of the charisma of the group.
We are all of an age, and I'm being presumptuous here, and you'll correct me if you think I'm wrong. We grew up in an era where defensive skills of a baseball player were valued and appreciated and recognized. I'm of the opinion that we are now in an era where defensive skills or liabilities are completely mitigated in favor of offensive abilities, that we judge players far more on their offensive skills and far more on their home run hitting abilities than we do their defense. And it is, you know, with due respect, it is to be acknowledged that Biggio, Bichette, Guerrero all have our defensive liabilities on this club, at least at this point. Tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't think that any of them is a perfect fit. at their current position, although it has been amazing how well Vladdy has played first base, considering how little he's played it.
Generally,
But the premise of that is interesting because you do have a lot of teams now that think that way. You have just watch guys play and you realize, you know, he's playing second. He's not really a second baseman. He's playing short. He's not really a shortstop. He's playing left field. He's not really an outfielder. You know, because of shifts, because of information, because of defensive positioning, you can maximize what a guy can do with defensive positioning in a way that you couldn't before. And so that's one way that teams are able to rationalize what you're talking about. The other thing to remember is we now live in a time where you can literally quantify everything that goes on a field. And you can project the value of a player's offense compared to what you might lose if you play him at a position on defense and whether it's worth the trade-off. And those are the decisions that teams make all the time. It's run production minus run prevention. What's the bottom line? You know, if a player gives you so much offense that you don't care where he plays, you can quantify that. If the value of that player's defense is so great that you don't care how much he hits, you can quantify that too. So recognize that this is really a math formula for a lot of these teams, and that's how they're making those decisions.
That sure sounds like Moneyball to me.
Well, you know, look, Moneyball's 20 years ago now.
I know.
It was the beginning of what we're talking about, of quantifying everything.
Right.
And interesting you mentioned Moneyball, because the Oakland A's won 11 in a row. And it brought to mind that Moneyball year where they wound up winning 20 and setting the American League record. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with more. Jason Stark of The Athletic is with us. Back after these. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, and Jason Stark of The Athletic is with us. He wrote a most intriguing piece about the Toronto Blue Jays in conversation with a whole variety of people, both present and former Blue Jays, principally executives, but a few others as well. And the term behemoth was raised and has kind of become the signature of the piece.
I Googled Behemothville. I can't find it still. So,
what's your sense of the work that Shapiro and Atkins have done in this? I mean, these are a couple of guys who worked in Cleveland with a low budget, who managed to make that franchise viable on the field over an extended period of time. They come to Toronto, realizing that there was at least the potential for the kind of money that would allow them to compete. Is there anything that they have done that is in question here, or have they done this all the right way, in your opinion?
I would say so far, so good. You know, nobody gets every decision right, but you know, what I've seen, because I spend so much time hanging out in Dunedin in spring training most years, would at least back in the before times, was how they have changed what the Blue Jays do, not just on the field, but off the field. You know, their high performance division is incredible. You know, I got to spend an hour one day with the architects of that division. And it's a reminder that, you know, we were just talking about how you quantify everything in baseball. That doesn't just extend to what guys do while they're playing. When you have a high performance division, it means you're looking into how do we maximize what every single player can be on the field and off the field? How do we create an environment where he stays the healthiest? How do we create an environment where he's less sleep deprived? He's less fatigued, because that the more fatigue, the more playing through fatigue, the more injury. Like, these are questions that they have spent so much time and money on building out. So I've seen that stuff. I've seen the way they've completely redesigned the facilities in Florida, the way that they have broken down the way they do things in the big leagues, the way they do things in the minor leagues, and reconstructed that. And they've built a system that is loaded with star potential prospects. I guess that's the way to put it. Like really high ceiling guys. And that's not an accident. They've done that very deliberately. And the way that they have built their team in the big leagues around this young core group, controllable for a lot of years, and now begun to supplement with free agents, with veteran players. This was all very meticulously done. It wasn't popular along the way, but there's a real method to the madness. It's what they did in Cleveland, except they couldn't afford to keep anybody in Cleveland.
That's right.
And their feeling is now they can.
Hey, you talked about the facility in Dunedin, because now the two juxtapositions that I think a lot of us have is, and we had Mark on a month ago, and he was effusive about what they've redone in Dunedin. And I think that could probably hopefully be a selling point for players to come. But then they have this darn stadium in Toronto. So are those two things opposite ends of some of the facilities issues that they probably have selling to players?
There's no doubt that Rogers Center is, in terms of creature comforts for players and revenue generating potential, you would have a hard time competing with some of these newer parks. They're palaces. They're amazing. And one of the great costs of the pandemic for the franchise was they couldn't move forward at all on any thoughts, any plans, any dreams for either remodeling Rogers Center or building something new right nearby. That stuff is going to happen at some point. It's an issue. It's an issue in multiple ways, but you can't do everything at once. So what they've done is what they had the ability to control. Hey, what they've even done in Dunedin is not something that everybody thought was going to happen. There was a time not so long ago, we thought they were going to leave Dunedin.
Yeah.
And when Mark got there, you know, he looked around at the options of, all right, where could you move? Where could you go? Versus what's the potential if we stay here and upgrade? And he had a vision of that. And this vision has come to life. The ballpark, even though they're playing big league games there, it's nothing special. But the facility at the old Engelbert complex, that's incredible. You could never have spent 5 minutes there back in the day and thought this is what it could become. But Mark looked at that and said, why not?
Well, the one thing, having been to the Engelbert complex on numerous occasions over the years, the one thing that was clear is there was space there. There was land.
Right.
Which which gave you the opportunity to imagine, perhaps, although I didn't, what could be. Clearly, Shapiro and Atkins and others did and have created it. Which now brings us to this other point, and I don't know John will raise his eyebrows as I address this.
Again.
Well, this organization, as we sit here today, has... I don't know how many pitchers, five pitchers on IR, two of their regular outfielders, although we know one's on the verge of coming back or arriving, more accurately, and Hernandez should
be coming back soon. Yeah, he's coming back soon.
It raises this question. The way the game is played today, we provide these athletes with 22nd century complexes with the most high-tech things you could possibly provide them, players still get hurt. We have pitchers now, if you get over 100 pitches, it's, text a friend because it's a rarity. And they're still going down. What's the balance here? Is in your opinion, is this game a little out of whack? I mean, I know they're doing it all for the right reasons, but there's a part of me that says they're not getting the results that they should be from all of this.
This is a unique time. in baseball, really all the sports. I mean, you're seeing all the injury issues in the NBA among the biggest stars right now. Everybody is coming off a really strange season because of timing, because of COVID, because of the number of games they played, because everything was so different. And now trying to ease back into essentially a full season, it's a challenge. You know, I've heard so many people in the game predict this is going to be the year of the injury. And that the teams that are able to keep their players, especially their star players, core players on the field, they're the teams that are probably going to win. Because there's no doubt that when you go from 60 games to 162, mm-hmm. that's an enormous health challenge. So just that is the foundation. But I mean, you're asking something that's fascinating in a much broader way is, all right, pitchers pitch less than they've ever pitched. More of them get hurt than have ever gotten hurt in history. And that's a function to some degree of just the incredible velocity in the game and the fact that maybe the human arm isn't capable of throwing 95 to 103 miles an hour, pitch after pitch after pitch, no matter what the workload is. So there's all of that. In terms of position players, you know, players train now in a different way than they've ever trained. The strength training is different. They train to build a certain level of athleticism that's different. And then baseball in particular is a fast twitch game that I think is conducive to certain types of injuries. And then the strength training, I don't think we fully understand all the ramifications of what that can mean when you try to play baseball 150 times a year. So we're still in the process of figuring all that out, but there's been a lot of breakthroughs too that certain teams think they've made. I think the Blue Jays are among those teams. And we're still in the process of learning and discovering whether they're breakthroughs at all. So I don't know, like this is the stuff that fascinates me too, but stay tuned on it. I think we'll have a better feel for it down the road.
You think the radar gun is the worst invention ever come to baseball?
Nobody uses radar guns anymore, man. Like, you know, we now, because of StatCast, you don't need to point the gun.
We can
measure stuff in ways we never measured it before. But I mean, the obsession with pitcher velocity.
Right.
That's the point.
It's at a whole different level than it was 20 years ago. When guys were pointing the radar guns, because pitchers train now to build velocity. I go ahead and go on a drive line to build the ability to throw a baseball at speeds never before seen. If a guy threw 94 net once upon a time, like he was a hard thrower. Mm. That's now the average velocity of a fastball in the sport. And like that ain't changing. In fact, it's creating enormous challenges for the game. It's why you see the Atlantic League is about to experiment with moving the mound back a foot, because if you don't counteract the effects of all the velocity and mounting velocity in the sport, you're going to have a 40% strikeout rate and the ball will never be in play. Can't have that.
Baseball used to be such a great game of subtlety. You know, whether it be in the infield, whether it be at bat, whether it be on the mound, and numbers aren't subtle. Numbers don't make the game subtle. And I think in many ways, and I mean, you know, I'm not a get off my lawn type of guy, but you know, the subtleties of how to manage, how to play the game have disappeared because we're all so rigid in numbers, and it's hurt the game in many ways, and yet. Some of the baseball we've seen is some of the best baseball ever.
You know, the nuances of the game are still there. They're just applied in different ways. And I think there's some things about baseball right now that are really exciting. I think we have the best collection of athletes playing baseball that we've ever had in the history of humanity. And they're armed every night with more information about all kinds of stuff than they've ever had at any point ever. And so that creates some incredible stuff that goes on on the field, off the field. Here's the problem is I've been talking about this for a few years now. What makes great baseball strategy does not necessarily make for great entertainment strategy. And if the ball's never in play, and right now it's in play less than it's ever been, there are just less opportunities to see great athletes do what they do best, what they're capable of. And I think that's kind of what you're alluding to, John. Everybody within the sport now understands that to create a more entertaining sport, you've got to have better rhythm. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. Not necessarily time of game, but just rhythm to the game. And you've got to have more great athletes running around the bases and making great plays in the field because they're capable of doing those things, except the ball actually lands on the field less than it ever has. And so like this is when you see all these experiments with the rules in the minor leagues, in the Atlantic League, this is the lab experiment that is going on behind the scenes as people in baseball try to figure out how do they get there? More rhythm, more guys run around the bases.
It's going to be interesting because, I mean, Theo Epstein's in the commissioner's office for a reason. And he got us to, he was one of the guys that got us to this point. And now he's got to get us out.
Right. He knows he's guilty. He's at least guilty in part. I've spent a lot of time talking to Theo in the last 6 months, and he is energized, man. And he's got a lot of thoughts on this stuff. I don't know where it's leading. You know, I don't know what the union will agree to. I don't know which of these things will be the answer and which of them will be a disaster. But I like the idea that they're trying stuff. Sure. I think the game needs to change. So let's see how these changes actually play in an environment away from the big leagues. And so you know what you can use and what you can't.
Well, it's interesting. We brought up two names of pitchers during this conversation. I don't think any more, but if we have, I mean, and the names are Ryu and Burley. And Ryu averages around 89, 90 for his fastball. And Burley was lucky to get it to 85 with his fastball. And both of them are quality pitchers.
Yeah.
Are you in favor of the notion of moving the mound back a foot? And doesn't that simply put a Band-Aid on a problem?
I don't know about that. Here's all right. I tried to explain this a few minutes ago, but let's think it through again. The average fastball of a major league pitcher 94. Is creeping toward 94 miles an hour. It's incredible how many guys routinely now throw 100 to 103. Jacob DeGrom is a starting pitcher. And he routinely hits 100 miles an hour. That's amazing. We've never lived in that world. And so when we talk about the problems in the game, I mean, the problems begin with that. It's not really the three true outcomes, guys. It's the one true outcome. It's the strikeout rate. The strikeout rate is incredible. More than 25% of all plate appearances now end in a strikeout. Watch guys pitching today and try to figure out how anybody ever gets a hit. We've never seen this array of stuff with this amount of information before, and the hitters need help. So if you're going to counteract the effects of all that velocity, what are your options? I don't want to move the mound back 5 feet. I think that's dangerous. I'm not even sure 2 feet is safe, but there have been enough studies now of moving it back 1 feet to know that could create enough of a distinction between how much time a hitter has to decide whether to swing, what kind of swing, versus great fastballs compared to what we're seeing now, that it's worth looking at. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to do that, what are you going to do to counteract all that velocity? Tell me. I have no idea.
Last point, we'll let you go. I mean, obviously, I'm chagrined that the game has changed as much as it has over the last 50 years. We're never going to see a 300-game winner. We're never going to see a guy throw 300 innings. Even complete games are a rarity. And those used to be more of a regularity. as we've talked about, a lot of it pertains to the velocity that is demanded upon pitchers now, and their inability to stay healthy, and inability to do that over 100 plus pitches. Does this ever go back, or is this, are we on a path to a destiny that we probably can't even imagine? What are your thoughts on that?
Bob, you probably don't even know. You just threw me like the ultimate batting practice fastball. First off, Bob,
hit it then.
I'm about to. First off, Doug Glanville and I had Theo on our Starkville podcast recently, and he put it this way. We've never had pitchers capable of doing the things that pitchers do now, and we've never asked them to do less. You know, and that's a really good way to put it. We're really getting close to the point where relief pitchers get more outs every game than starting pitchers. I don't think that's good for baseball as an entertainment entity. Mm-hmm. And so now here's why that was a batting practice fastball, because there's a rule being tried out in the Atlantic League this year that I even though people have been calling it the Jason Stark rule, I did not invent it, but I did name it. It's called the double hook. And the idea is every team would have the universal DH, but once your DH leaves, or once your starting pitcher leaves the game, you lose your DH for the rest of that game. And it's one of those deals where the more you start to think about, you use the word subtleties, the subtleties of this rule, the more interesting it gets, because it's a rule designed to create more incentive than we've had in years for teams to leave their starting pitcher in the game. If your DH is Nelson Cruz, if your DH is Big Poppy, even if your DH is Teoscar Hernandez, and that guy's coming up next inning, do you really want to take your starting pitcher out just because the data shows he's about to go through the lineup the third time? There's tremendous incentive for managers to keep pitchers, starting pitchers in the game with this rule.
I like that.
If you're going to have this rule, you might have to build your roster completely differently. You might have to develop pitchers completely differently. You might have a whole different type of DH, for example, a guy who's versatile enough so that when the starting pitcher leaves the game, you then flip him into the field and let him play a position. There are enormous implications of this rule. And I've written about it a lot. I've talked to Adam Wainwright, Max Scherzer, guys like Adam Dunn about it. And there's lots of fun opinions about it, but we've never seen it. And it might be, this is the answer. It also might be, this is a disaster full of unintended consequences. But here's the thing, nobody's ever listened to one idea I've ever had in my life, including in my house. Now, for some reason, baseball's taken one of my ideas and they're going to use it in actual games. I'm shocked that this happened.
Well,
congratulations on that. I think it's a brilliant idea.
You must be in the same house I'm in, Jason.
No. Right. We talk. Nobody's listening.
We've all been in that house. Trust me. Jason, thank you so much for your time today. We greatly appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have a chance to chat down the road. It's a fascinating discussion that could go on for hours and hours, as you know. But that's the nature of baseball. If you love the game, the intricacies of it and the debates over all the little pieces just go on and on and on. Thanks a lot.
Bob, John, really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Jason Stark of The Athletic, back to wrap it after these messages.
This week on The Sign-Off, Brian Ehrenworth tells the story of how he unknowingly outbid Wayne Gretzky in the fight to represent Sidney Crosby.
There was a fellow in that meeting. His name was Pat Brisson. He says, Brian, I have a hockey player that I'd like you to consider. And he said the name, Sidney Crosby. I remember leaving the meeting thinking, I better do some homework on this Sidney Crosby kid. And Pat said that there were other people looking to get Sidney under their umbrella.
Okay.
It's the same year, 2003. I'm having breakfast with Mike. All of a sudden, Mike gets a tap on the shoulder, and I look up, and it's Wayne. You guys mind if I have breakfast with you?
Yeah, sorry, this seat's taken, sir. How dare you?
At the breakfast table, Sydney's name came up. Wayne said something like, oh yeah, did we get that deal, Mike?
Oh my God.
So it turns out that the people that we were bidding against
were your partners,
WG Authentic and Wayne Gretzky. Because I didn't know that at the time.
The Sign Off is available on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Cowan and Shannon with you again. Our thanks to Jason Stark. And
you two are going to get on a roll there about rule changes.
Well, you know, that's kind of my thing.
I know.
You know,
I love the double DH thing, the double hook thing. That's not a bad idea.
I think it's really intriguing. But again, you know, I said before, like, you know, moving the mound back a foot is like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. You know, it just perpetrates the philosophy that the game is in right now. And that's the part that I would like to see change.
Yeah.
I would like to see guys who can throw 89 mile an hour fastballs, but spot it, like the Burleys, like the Ryus. I'd like to see more opportunity for them. And you know what it relates to, John?
Mm.
An era in hockey where you had to be 6'4" and 230 pounds.
Well,
and they took away the game from the 5'10" artistic guy.
Yeah.
And they basically have given it back to him.
Well, it took hockey a whole year off to reinvent the game that way in 2005. It took a whole year.
I think it's going to take, it's not going to be up to the general managers to make that fundamental decision. It's going to be some tweaking of a rule or something that happens that I can't even imagine.
I know we got to go, but I'll tell you what, Jason talked about one thing about how the Jays have the one model because they're the only team here. It's the same model the Raptors are using. And the Raptors have a captive audience. It's Raptors and the Blue Jays have a huge advantage compared to, in many ways, compared to some of their U.S. counterparts.
Yeah, although it is also fair to say that when we talk about 7 million people watch, that has happened, but it happens only in World Series and postseason games, and you got to get there.
Yep.
Have a nice weekend yourself, and we'll see you on Monday if the crick don't rise. Thank you everybody for watching or listening, as the case may be. Until then, goodbye from Toronto.